Hi, everyone, and welcome to Literary Loitering, your weekly dose of everything that is literary. It's a place where there's not enough literary and far too much loitering.
Far too much.
Yes. Today we are going to be loitering with intent to talk about books and various other things. But before we do that, I'm joined today by Andy.
Yes.
And Owen.
Hello.
How are you guys doing today?
Pretty good.
Good.
Everyone's good.
It's great.
Yes.
The weather's great as well,
for a change.
It's a bit cold out there. It's a bit nippy.
Under the shade.
Yes, as always, this is Rob talking, and I will attempt to let other people talk this week. It's my New Year's resolution, you know, a long time after New Year's.
Yeah, you've not been doing so well.
It's March, you know, Rob.
Yes, I know. My sense of time is very, very Asian. Am I allowed to say that? I don't know.
You can, yes.
I may have to cut that bit. I'm not sure. Anyway, moving on. We've got news for everybody today, starting off with Akhil Sharma, whose book Family Life took 13 years to write, but the head judge at the Folio Prize for Fiction, which he won, has said it's a masterful novel of distilled complexity. Interesting. Basically, the Indian-American writer Akhil Sharma has been named the winner of the second Folio Prize for Fiction. It took him 13 long and painful years to complete, charting one immigrant family's heart-wrenching search for the American dream. Writing it, he admitted, after receiving the £40,000 prize, was a frustrating, difficult challenge, often like chewing stones, with around 9 wasted years when it did not go well. I'm glad the book exists. I just wish I hadn't been the guy who wrote it, he said. So I think it's very much, the fact that he's spent 13 years writing it, it's very much a labour of love.
Definitely.
How long is the book, does it say?
I think it's just a kind of a standard-sized novel, a few hundred pages long. But probably longer, probably about 500-600 pages. But to spend 13 years writing it, yeah. I mean, that's a hell of a struggle.
Usually you'd get, after 3 years, when you'd start on something new.
Yeah, I mean, you'd kind of give up after a while. Mm. It's a credit to his determination that he's actually stuck with it and pursued it and made sure he finished it. Because there are a lot of writers out there, a lot of authors out there who will start a project, but as soon as they've hit writer's block for a couple of years, you know, or even a couple of months in some cases, they give up.
Mm.
You know, it's a testament to his dedication to what he was doing. So, yes, congratulations to him for winning the prize. I think it's well-deserved in this case.
Mm.
You know,
definitely.
Moving on to a bit of Clarkson news on our, on the UK's Clarkson Watch.
yes.
Jeremy Clarkson, the BBC Director General Tony Hall is understood to have decided that he has little alternative after the reports of a fracas or a rumpus or whatever word you want to use between Jeremy Clarkson and a producer, in which allegedly and reportedly Clarkson punched the producer and sent him to hospital. Clarkson's contract will not be renewed after the Top Gear presenter was involved in the 30-second physical assault. And, yeah, you know, Tony Hall's been left with pretty much no alternative. Mm. If you punch a producer, then that's pretty much it, game over. I don't understand what the issue was, but...
It was over a steak dinner.
Food,
essentially, yeah.
It was over food?
It was over catering or something.
Let me get this straight. He punched someone over food.
Allegedly.
With his amount of money and the fact that we live in the UK where there is no famine.
Apparently they didn't have
food shortage.
They didn't have steak and chips or steak and chips was cold or something.
I'm not sure. I didn't look that much into it.
How much of a prima donna do you have to be to go down that route?
The thing is, you can't really... I'm not defending him if he did it. That's what should have happened.
Mm.
You know, with the BBC, should be let go.
Yeah.
But when they're saying he allegedly did it after an investigation, they found out I did. I want to know what that. I'd like to know what that investigation was.
Yeah.
Because
you'd like more transparency about it.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, Clarkson has stepped on a couple of landmines in the past, and the BBC has always saved his bacon, but I think this is just kind of one straw too many.
I think we've said, though, as well, when he's like controversial when he used to, on Top Gear from, like, obviously, yeah, throughout the years. They've said there's room for that kind of presenter. They want that there, but they can't.
Well, I mean, apparently it was a 30-second physical assault after a 20-minute verbal tirade.
Yeah.
You know.
That's things you don't know what was said in those 20 minutes. I mean, it could have just escalated into such a point where, you know, he just got so infuriated. I mean, it might have gone past that. We don't completely know all the facts. The BBC do, but don't. So
let's put it this way: Clarkson has survived some really controversial stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Really controversial stuff. And when you get right down to it, their biggest earner at one point was what's his face? Can't pronounce his R's.
Jonathan Ross. Yeah.
Jonathan Ross. Yes. Mm. Jonathan Ross was basically the highest paid person, and. Yeah. He did that whole thing with Russell Brand about, Jonathan Sachs, was it?
Yes.
No.
And
I think it was Andrew Sachs.
Andrew Sachs. They did that whole thing, and they got rid of Jonathan Ross. The main reason, I think, why Clarkson got away with so much controversial stuff was because Tony Hall is a fan of Top Gear.
Mm.
You know, so, and the BBC values Top Gear as one of its prime commodities. But I think that kind of went, that's kind of gone to Clarkson's head.
Mm. He knows that the shows, isn't it one of the most successful shows now?
It's sold all around the world, and even the British versions are still kind of covered and dubbed and sold all around.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Clarkson's contract with the BBC was due to expire at the end of March. And obviously there were probably talk in negotiations for the contract to be renewed, because Top Gear does get a lot of viewers.
Yeah.
But I am curious as to what's going to happen now. Weren't there reports of, someone like Chris Evans ahead, at the top of the...
Chris Evans was one of the names put forward that would probably replace him, because he is a massive petrol head.
Yeah, but I don't know. I can't see Chris Evans...
It makes you think, though, doesn't it? If Top Gear continued with new host, if the other two don't do it.
The other two have said that they won't do it without Clarkson there.
What would fans watch? What if Jeremy Clarkson left? Is it James May,
Richard Hammond.
What if they all went to ITV and started a motor show?
Or even Sky? You know?
People would go across to that, because at the end of the day, Clarkson's name does carry weight with regards to when it comes to motoring shows, but I don't know. I think it's all gone to his head a little bit.
Mm.
He thought he could get away with everything.
Yeah, I mean, things like Jeremy Clarkson, he set up a company that sole purpose was to sell Top Gear merchandise, Top Gear, basically publicize it. So he goes and. I don't know what happens with that.
Yeah. Well, negotiations with May and Hammond about their contracts have been put on hold during the investigation, so we'll have to see what happens. If anything does happen, we'll keep you updated. Moving on, some slightly strange news here. I'm not sure how to describe this. Yes. A US conceptual poet called Kenneth Goldsmith has defended himself in the wake of heavy criticism after his reading of Michael Brown's autopsy report in the form of a poem on the 13th of March. And there has been a massive backlash about this, you know, in the poetry world, which, albeit kind of small, you know, is still quite vociferous in how they approach things. Goldsmith, an admired writer who has published 10 books of poetry and teaches writing at the University of Pennsylvania, performed The Body of Michael Brown at Interrupt 3, a weekend-long arts event at Brown University. Brown was the unarmed black 18-year-old who was fatally shot last summer in Ferguson, Missouri, by a white police officer. Right. Now, I can kind of get why he's done it like this. You know, he's done it to kind of express a particular type of emotion, a particular concept, something like that. You know, he's a conceptual poet. He's done it for reasons that to him are valid. I'm not sure whether the subject matter was the correct choice, though.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, he could have probably done something like something that wasn't as hot buttoned or on the topic, but I don't know. I mean, I don't feel I know enough about it to actually say.
Mm.
I mean, it does seem like a dangerous thing to do at first, but...
Haven't we seen things like that before, though, haven't we, with poetry? It's always...
Yeah.
I mean...
Well, poetry is all, has had some major controversies over the last few years. I mean, there was all the plagiarism scandals last year, which really caught us off guard. But yeah, Goldsmith is apparently a conceptual poet known for what he calls uncreative writing. His book, Seven American Deaths and Disasters, is a transcription of quotes from radio and television reports of national tragedies, including the shooting of John F. Kennedy, forming a series of prose poems. It knocks the air from your lungs, wrote the New York Times in a review. But I'm not sure whether that's in a good way or a bad way.
It doesn't quite seem like it's a necessary in a good way.
Well, when he started, before he started reading this, there was some brief announcements, and then Goldsmith got on the stage apparently, and he said the poem was something to do with quantified self, but apparently that after that there were very few introductory remarks. According to one of the artist Faith Holland, who attended the reading, his reading was unemotional and relatively even, and his feet moved rhythmically the entire time. I am very, very curious about what Michael Brown's family make of this, because at the end of the day, they're the ones who were hurt the most by his death.
Their opinion is the most important.
Yes. If he hasn't received permission from the family to do this, to do the autopsy report as a performance piece, then I seriously question his ethics, because at the end of the day, you should never, ever, ever use the death of anybody as a performance piece without their family's permission.
No.
And because it's, for me, it feels more like self-aggrandizement. You know, you're just kind of making yourself look better through someone else's misery. I don't like that at all.
Yeah. I am hoping that he did ask and they completely approved.
Mm. Yeah. I'm hoping that he actually performed it for them first.
Yeah.
So that they actually understood what the performance was going to be. And the reasons why.
If that's the case, then it puts the people that have been quite negative about it more in a negative light themselves.
Yes.
Because they're saying all these bad things about it, but if it's something the family wanted and were very happy about, then...
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. If he's got family, the family's permission, then, you know, then that's between him and the family. But without that, you know...
It's going to be controversial anyway.
Yeah, it's going to be controversial anyway. Anyway, moving on, Alan Moore. His second novel is due to come out in 2016, and it's called Jerusalem. It's a fantastical exploration of his hometown of Northampton, which runs to more than a million words in draft form and is slated for publication next spring. 1 million words! 1 million words! I'm sorry, what?
How big's the finger?
Think about it like this. The average dissertation is how long?
8,000.
8,000 for a dissertation?
Between 8 and 10.
8 and 10. Mm. And, you know, your thesis for your doctorate is can be up to like 50,000, can it?
Mm. Will make something there.
Yeah, but, can be, in some cases it can be up to 50,000.
So he's basically written a lot.
People, if it's in book format, like... Give average size.
Yeah.
Isn't it usually like the 100,000 word mark that where you get like 600, 700 pages?
Somewhat like that, I suppose.
So you're
yeah.
looking at like 7,000 pages. like that.
I'm just gonna. I don't think that book's gonna fit through my letterbox.
Oh, that definitely isn't. I mean, you're probably gonna have to sign for that.
Yeah. Describing the novel as Tony Bennett at UK publishers Knockabout Comics has described the novel as Moore's best work to date, rich and glorious. They expect that it will be a spring 2016 title published in the UK at the same time as in North America. A firm announcement about the publication date will be made late this year, and with with the book currently undergoing editing and proofreading. Now, don't get me wrong, Alan Moore does have some great ideas. you know, some brilliant ideas. And he is an icon in the world of comic books. But I'm not sure. I'm curious about how this book is going to play out.
It'll take some people longer to read it than it did for him to write it.
Yeah.
That'll be, and if you didn't want to read it, I suppose if you're really small, you can use it to stand on.
Yes.
Like to read something off.
Yes. Balance tables with it.
That's a hell of a short leg, isn't it?
You have to buy two.
I suppose if it's no good, then you could basically get a bunch of these and make your own coffee table.
Why not?
Okay, you guys have some news as well, don't you?
Yes, but I just want to quickly say, because you were saying that it had been alleged that Jamie Clarkson might be sacked. It actually has been confirmed.
No, it's been confirmed.
I'm just saying, 350 million viewers for Top Gear as well.
It's confirmed, like, officially now.
Yeah. It's been confirmed. As I said, Tony Hall had no choice. Right, we got some news from you guys as well. What have we got?
Well, I have some Top Gear news.
Top Gear?
No.
Don't worry, I'll trim it out.
Thank you. I have some Doctor Who news.
Yes.
Back to the BBC. A Tom Baker era script is going to be lengthened and turned into a novel.
Yeah.
By author James Goss.
Yeah, but it's who wrote the script, which is the important bit.
Yes, it was Douglas Adams.
Yes, the late, great Douglas Adams of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy fame. Do we know what the script was about? It was called The City of Death, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. It's a tale of time travel, intrigue, holidays in Paris, dashed off in a weekend.
I think it's been broadcast because City of Death aired in 1979.
It did, yes.
It remains one of Doctor Who's most popular serials. It
was watched by 16 million viewers.
Yes, so when it was first broadcast.
I think at that time that's quite substantial.
It was when, you remember Doctor Who's companions? It was when his companion was Romana or Lala Ward, and the holiday in Paris, they were embroiled in the alien schemes of Count Scarlioni, splintered into multiple aspects when his ship exploded over primeval Earth. The villainous Count has been attempting to guide the planet towards inventing time travel ever since, so that he will be able to go back and save his ship.
It's quite a story, like.
Yeah. Well, it's the kind of thing that you expect from Douglas Adams when it comes to science fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, who else is going to think about The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? Tell me. Can you name one author who could come up with a concept like that?
Oh, that's... Nah. I mean, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, that is...
And the fact that a towel is, like, essential for hitchhiking.
Yeah. I can see what you mean. They're both quite out there.
Yeah.
Both stories are. And so I think I think that's the reason why this was chosen, because, like you say, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, it's a great story by him. And so having something like this, something else that he's created, and turn it into a novel, I think it's just a great step forward. It's kind of showing, once again, how much he can think outside this, right? He can think outside the box. And although I don't know much about James Goss, I'm hoping he can do it justice.
Yes.
It's very rare that you get like a script going into a book, like a novel, isn't it?
It is. It's not a common thing, especially a TV script. But then again, it's Doctor Who, and there's been a lot of novelizations of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Some of them have been related to scripts, and some of them have just been, you know, completely original stories. I mean, there's even the Doctor Who comics as well.
Oh, aye.
So, yeah.
I think the only times I've known of scripts being turned to books is scripts that have been written, but they know won't be aired. I think they did the same thing with the Stargate Atlantis movie. They knew it wasn't going to be made, so they turned it into a book.
Didn't they do that with Red Dwarf as well?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, they've done a couple. I mean, there is the Red Dwarf script that was turned into a novel afterwards, which was, the episode Backwards?
Yes. Oh, is that
that, that was actually turned in, Rob Grant and Doug Naylor turned that into a book called Backwards, which goes into a lot more detail about it. Apparently, time is supposed to run backwards. That's the natural way time is supposed to run. Seriously.
I love science fiction.
I think I remember that episode when they went so far in the future that everything was just going in on itself, so time was going backwards.
No, they went into an alternate reality.
Oh, right. So
there's an alternate reality.
Went to non-null.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not null.
They were kind of the only forward-moving people in the world.
And they became performers because of it, weren't they?
Yeah, they became performers because of it. And it was just the last bit where Kat...
Yes. I don't think
we need
to
watch
go
that episode tonight.
Yeah. I hope they didn't go into too much detail about that whole thing.
Yes, it's the look on Danny John Jewell's face at the end. It's just priceless.
Just don't say a word.
Yes, and above all, don't panic. Anyway, Andy, you got some news for us?
While we were on the topics of poems, this isn't what we're finishing the show on. This was the Russian teacher.
Yes.
Kills friend in heated poetry versus prose.
Yeah, give us some details. I want to know what the hell happened.
A Russian teacher allegedly killed a friend in a drunken argument over literary genres, investigations have said.
Have said.
In a statement, federal police in the Russian region of... This is complicated, I can't read this. Sverdlovsk said the host insisted that real literature is prose. While his guest, a former teacher, argued for poetry, the suspect fled his home in the town of Erbit in the Ural Mountains, where the 67-year-old victim was killed on 20th of January. So it was quite a while back before he was found in a nearby village and arrested by Russian police on charges of murder.
Wow!
And the incident, this is best bit, comes 4 months after a similar argument.
What
over the theories of German philosopher Immanuel Kant? Kant, who argued that reason is the source of morality, resulting in a man being shot in a grocery store.
Was this also in the same town? Was it also in the same town, though?
It sounds it.
It does it look it?
Well, it's related to it, yeah. In a grocery store, though, that one.
What?
I knew the Russians were passionate, but, you know.
I'm actually at a loss for words.
If you ever went to Russia, you'd have to watch yourself.
Oh, God, yeah. I don't...
Your views, Rob, were just...
I'd be hunted by the KGB, even though they apparently don't exist anymore.
Allegedly.
Seriously, I've been in arguments about poetry and prose, and nobody gets killed over them. The more
in Russia,
I mean, in Soviet Russia, poetry kills you.
Ironic if somebody written a poem about it.
I mean, seriously, who kills somebody over an argument about poetry versus prose? Who in their right mind would kill somebody over that argument?
I really hope a poem is made out of that. I really do. I'd just love to read that poem.
I know somebody died and it's horrible that somebody died, but at the end of the day, my God, just how passionate do you have to be? Seriously, passionately do you have to fight your corner? Can you not give some ground? Can you not compromise? Find some median point where you can both agree?
I say something, though. It makes the whole Jeremy Clarkson argument and fracas seem very...
No. It makes it sound more like a rumpus than a fracas.
Fracas,
anything. Yeah. It's more of a rumpus now rather than a fracas. So, yes... context is everything.
You must have lost the argument then.
That's a definite loss.
What's the point in arguing and then winning and then murdering somebody?
What is he, 12? Is he 12 and on the internet?
With access to a knife and a shotgun.
Yes. Right, you're going to move on to a better story. Owen, you got any more news for us?
Yes, I have some Arthur Conan Doyle news.
Oh, goody.
Yes, we haven't talked about him in a while. Apparently, Staffordshire Police... fabricated evidence to try and discredit Arthur Conan Doyle.
Really?
Basically, yeah.
Isn't a recent thing, then, I take it.
Oh, no. Not.
I was going to say.
It has recently been revealed at an auction. Basically, these letters were fabricated because they were trying to discredit Arthur Conan Doyle's investigation into the case of George, I think it's Edel G? I can't pronounce that name.
Spell it.
Edalji.
Edalji.
Edalji, all right. Of George Edalji, a I'll say that again. The case of George Adalji, a Birmingham... I'll try that one more time. The case of George Adalji, a Birmingham solicitor who was accused of maiming horses and sending poison pen letters at the turn of the 20th century.
Wow. I mean, so was there any reason given as to why they would fake evidence?
Well, it just says they would attempt to discredit Doyle by creating an elaborate ruse. So I think, I don't know, I guess they were either...
They must have really hated Arthur Conan Doyle. See, I mean, seriously.
With all that effort.
Yeah.
Why? I think for all, police authors that write crime novels then try to become detectives themselves, I think they find annoying. They must have just found it completely irritating and just tried to stop him. Either that or they just wanted him to look like he was involved.
Yeah, but there's nothing new with police disliking, authors who solve crimes. I mean, just look at Murder, She Wrote.
Castle,
don't get me started on them TV ones.
Yeah, and Castle, good choice there, Castle as well.
Yes.
I mean, you're telling me, right? She's an author in Murder, She Wrote, right?
Well, actually, no.
She hasn't been offered a job to solve the crimes, after all.
No, I think she's actually the living embodiment of death itself. Because if you notice, every time Jessica Fletcher turns up in a town, somebody dies. Seriously.
Like, won't move there.
Yeah, nobody wants to move to Midsummer. So, I mean, the risk of death is actually quite high there. I mean, their life insurance premiums must be a nightmare.
But it's a nice quiet town.
Welcome to Midsummer. Population dropping.
A bit fair in terms of Jessica Fletcher, that's got to be great publicization of her books, you know. She just, wherever she goes, she solves a crime, solves a murder, sells another book.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, like I said, every time she turns up, somebody dies.
Mm.
Isn't she? Doesn't,
I think she's done I mean, it.
Exactly. I was about to say, she solved so many murders, right? Allegedly.
Mm.
But the murders happen when she turns up. Mm. Surely some police officer somewhere has basically thought, would have basically put two and two together and come up with a plausible four. Hang on. Everywhere you go, somebody dies. And then you suddenly solve the murder and someone else gets blamed for it. Is this convenient? You know, it's the same MO every single time.
There's loads though like that where they're not actually supposed to be solving the crime. And it makes me...
Well, I mean, they had like Miss Marple. I mean, at least with Poirot, he was an actual detective.
True.
You know, the David Suchet Poirot was, with his little mustache and everything like that. I thought David Suchet was great.
He was fantastic. Yeah.
Which was the one where he was a doctor in a hospital?
I can't remember.
Or something. Yeah.
And David Suchet.
He had a brother that was the police officer. But
was
the one that
it's his son.
Murder.
It's his son.
Dick Van Dyke. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, I know. That's another one. Is like somebody's dead.
Yeah.
I know he worked in a hospital. So
right. But. Can I quickly get back to this?
Yeah.
Yes,
sorry, we derailed you.
Yes, you did. It gave me time to properly read. The case for Dalji was he'd been sentenced to 7 years for 7 years hard labour for the animal mutilation and letter writing, released after 3 years, and asked for Conan Doyle to help prove his innocence.
Ah.
Yes. Dalji himself was son of an Indian father and English mother, and Doyle was convinced that colour and race did play a part in him being convicted.
Well, it probably did. I mean,
it was 1903.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, you're talking about during the height of the empire.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
There was a lot of racism going on, with lots and lots of English people, which is one, lots and lots of English people believing that they were better than all of the lesser races.
Yes.
You know, the ones from darkest Africa and darkest India. And I wonder why, I kept wondering why they kept using the word dark. Elements of racism, I believe.
Yep.
Anyway, we're going to move on.
Yes.
We've got one last story before, unless you guys have another story. We've got one last story before we take a break.
Oh,
and this one's a good one.
Is this what I'm thinking?
What?
Well, just gone.
Right. Obviously, Terry Pratchett passed away a couple of weeks ago. March 12th it was. But he didn't go without leaving us one last gift. There is a new Discworld novel coming out Aside from the book he wrote with Stephen Baxter, which is the part of the Long Earth series, which I think is called The Long Utopia, which will be available from Transworld Publishers at some point. There's one more Discworld book, and it's a Tiffany Aching book called The Shepherd's Crown. Now, the Tiffany Aching series is basically starts off with the We Three Men, goes on to Hatful of Sky, then Wintersmith, and then I Shall Wear Midnight. And they're great books for teenagers. They're very, very good books for teenagers, especially girls. I would advise anybody who's got a cousin or a daughter or a sister who's in their teenage years, early to mid-teens, get them the We Three Men, to read. My niece loves the Tiffany Aching books. She absolutely adores them. And she normally doesn't read fantasy, but when it comes to those books, she loves them because the characters are so vibrant. And the Nack McFeagle, who basically they're pixies, but you know how they always have fairies and brownies and pixies for all the for like the daisies and the forget me nots and the little buttercups and stuff like that. Well, they're pixies spelled PICTSIES. They're the ones who are kind of the fairies for the thistles and the ugly flowers that are spiky and horrible.
Okay.
Yes, and there's nothing they love more than drinking and fighting and stealing. The only thing they love more than drinking and fighting and stealing is drinking and fighting and stealing all at once.
Why do you separately?
Allegedly, they were kicked out. They reckon they rebelled against the Fairy Queen. But the alternative version, which is often told by people in the know, was that they were kicked out of Fairyland for being drunk. Yes, and they wear so many tattoos that their skin looks blue, but it's actually not. They're very, 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 very old school Celtic. We're thinking. Imagine Braveheart, but with with men who are only six inches tall, or smaller than that, and most of them are called Jock. Seriously, there's one called Big Jock, but with bigger than Wee Jock Jock.
It sounds like something you're just making up on top of your head.
I'm not. It was not as big as Medium Jock, but bigger than Wee Jock Jock.
Dear. I think when we talked about his passing, I think we said that we would love if there was just like one last nugget from him. And
I think we found it. I like the Nack McFeagle as characters, and I am very much looking forward to The Shepherd's Crown. Pratchett had a couple of others, a couple of other books that weren't Discworld books. Nation is one of them. Nation is a brilliant book. Dodger is one that he wrote, which is a loose version of The Artful Dodger from Oliver Twist. There's a couple of others, collections of short stories and essays, A Blink of the Screen and A Flick of the Keyboard. And obviously there's the Long Earth series, which is actually really interesting. His work with Stephen Baxter was really good. There's all that wealth of stuff. So if you get a chance, if you've never read anything by Pratchett, dip your toe in, start off somewhere.
But I do think his last book being a Discworld just cements his legacy. I think it really does.
Yes, it does. Anyway, we're going to take a break there, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
If you'd like comical and informative banter on the world of comics and manga, then check out 4Panel, the geek show's dedicated comic podcast, or Yon Paru, if you prefer manga.
Welcome back to Literary Lightman. Welcome back to Literary Lightman. Been quite a diverse show so far. Owen, you've got something to talk about.
Yes, I have a review to do. I think it's the only review we have today. I've got a book here from author Daryl Gregory called Harrison Squared.
This has something to do with Cthulhu, doesn't it?
It has the ideas around Cthulhu, yeah.
It's the H.P. Lovecraft stuff.
Yeah, it's that kind of old giant sea monster thing. But It.
Okay, so what's Harrison Squared about?
Right, basically, Harrison Squared is about a lad whose name is Harrison Harrison.
What?
Yes. It is Harrison. It's some kind of family tradition where, for the generations, I think the firstborn sons have to have a double name.
Okay.
So he's Harrison Harrison, called
People
Harrison.
People do have a double name.
Yep. So he's called Harrison Squared, but he's Harrison Harrison the fifth. So he's Harrison Squared times five. So
okay.
Yeah, his the reason for it is because his family are scientists, so it's kind of a sciencey joke for them.
Okay.
But they're marine biologists, and unfortunately he lost his father at a young age, and because he didn't know so much about what happened, well, he knew what happened, but his mind kind of gave this whole thing that his father was killed by some kind of giant colossal squid, and he gave that the reason for the death. So it, and this kind of changes the way he perceives the world throughout, and as a result, he's kind of scared of water, but his mum's still the adamant marine biologist. So they moved to this new kind of creepy town in Massachusetts.
What's the town called?
Dunsmuth.
Dunsmuth.
All right, Dunsmouth.
So. Dunsmouth. So it's kind of a play on the... Because in the Lovecraft stuff, it's Innsmouth. Innsmouth. Yes. Where all the Cthulhu-type mythos generally takes place. So... it's a play on that, isn't it?
It is, yes. It is. And you do get the kind of... There are the kind of subtle kind of references that you can... There are the subtle references that you can enjoy if you do know much about the Cthulhu stuff, so it is worth getting. The main story kind of centers around that his mother's now gone missing, and so he kind of now has to try and figure out what's happened and sort of face his demons.
Okay. So, who is this by? Daryl Gregory?
Daryl Gregory, yes.
So, who's Daryl Gregory? I've never heard of this author.
Right. Well, it's quite surprising because he is responsible for writing at least two Planet of the Apes volumes of graphic novels.
Really?
Yes. One called Children of Fire. The other, if I can just bring it up, The Devil's Pawn.
Interesting.
Yep. So, he writes the stories and then the other... They are then illustrated, but...
Has he done any other kind of... Because this sounds a bit kind of... It sounds kind of a bit horror, but not quite horror.
It does seem like it. I mean, another one he's got is Pandemonium. It's 1950s. Random acts of possession begin to occur.
So he's done some kind of horror-based stuff in the past.
Then there's the Devil's Alphabet.
What, is that just like Satan playing Scrabble?
I don't know. But anyway, back to this. I think it is a good book. It kind of if you just look at it and think, oh, great, sea monsters, fantastic, it kind of takes a few pages to get started properly.
Okay.
But, I mean, today I was I'd missed a train, so I was stuck in the station reading the book, and I think it's one of those perfect books for that. So if you miss a train or you're on a train and you got time, it's definitely one of those books you could just sit and read.
A public transport book.
Hmm. Yeah.
So it's not like those spy thrillers you take on holiday. You wouldn't read this on holiday, you'd only read it on public transport.
Well, no, I'm saying it's one of those I would read this on holiday. I mean, I probably wouldn't read it, like, say, on a cruise.
Yes, okay, right. Thank you so much for that review, Owen. We're going to move into some interesting stuff from World Poetry Day.
Yes.
Now, found this on the Telegraph, and I thought, this is a brilliant article. World Poetry Day happened.
it happened. We can't deny it.
Yes, it happened. And people took to Twitter in droves to post their poetic tweets, and some of them were downright hilarious.
I love Twitter.
This article starts off, her name was Yoda, a showgirl she was, which I think is genius. But yes, very first one here, 50 Shades of Gran. Roses are red, violets are blue, sugar is sweet, but I can't have any because I've got type 2 diabetes. Number one, she's making a comedic poem about diabetes, and number two, she's called 50 Shades of Gran. That's just like the best name for a grandmother who's tweeting.
I mean, there was another one on there, like the top one there. Yet it's World Poetry Day, yet still a disappointing lack of the mix about juice and orange. I just think that's clever. Yes.
Well, yeah, how can you... what rhymes with orange?
Dawhinge.
Hey? Dawhinge. Dawhinge. Dawhinge.
But...
yes, we know orange is actually a word.
Oh, borange. So, yeah, apparently borange is a word, so...
Lozenge.
Lozenge. Lozenge. Oh, well
Jason
done.
Jason Orange takes an orange. Jason Orange takes a lozenge. How do I go from there?
Was that a euphemism?
No.
Right, okay.
Always lozengitis.
Okay.
Yes.
Well...
yes. Brian Bilston has put one down called The Explosion. Never put a Minto into Vimto. That's how the dinosaurs became extincto.
I found one. I found one I particularly like from someone called Frugal. I wandered lonely as a cloud. Really, Wordsworth? This is Britain. No cloud is ever lonely.
This is a great one from Rob Dickin about Michael McIntyre. Shriek, snort, face all pained. The comedy routine of McIntyre explained.
I've got one here from Boothby Graffour.
It's Boothby Graffour. He's a comedy. He's a stand-up comic.
Say
Boothby Graffour is a stand-up right. comic.
See, I've got one from Boothby Graffour. Total eclipse. I don't care. Look, everybody, the sun's not there. I didn't bother to save my eye. Watched it later. Saw it on Sky.
Andy, you got any?
Dead Italian chef, here today, gone tomato.
Oh,
he ran out of time.
That's more for our pun show last week.
He ran out of time. that's awful. That's awful.
But you've got like two convey one's mood in 17 syllables is very diffic.
But Jack Underwood has put, great that the everyday contempt for poetry in the media is being offset this World Poetry Day by a campaign monetizing poems to buy coffee. This was in response to a campaign apparently for free coffee in return for a poem. Not sure how that works.
I might give that a try at Starbucks then.
Yes. Anyway. From Andy Dutton, starts work on a novel. Oh, it's World Poetry Day. Settles for a haiku. yes. There's some great ones. I've just seen the Dead Italian Chef one. Keena Shree ends this yes. pretty much with a good one saying, and please, people, rap is no poetry, ever.
Yeah, it's not.
I'm not sure. Is rap poetry? Is it?
No. Are we really going to delve into this kind of...
Hip-hop, I'll admit, is poetry.
Huh? Oh, apparently...
I kind of disagree with the whole idea that rap isn't isn't poetry, because hip-hop is poetry. There's a lot of hip-hop artists who are poets. To name but a few, Idea from Idea and Abilities, who sadly passed away, Scroobius Pip, is definitely a poet. Sage Francis is definitely a poet. These guys are all do hip-hop, and rap is kind of just a form of hip-hop. Now, I know that most people who think of rap do think of people like 50 Cent and, you know, Snoop Dogg and stuff like that, and that's also a form of rap, but that's very much kind of... that's not really the kind of rap that we're talking about. We're talking about more of the underground stuff where... I mean, Tupac Shakur started life as... you know, started his career as a street poet. According to one of our colleagues here, B. Dolan said that rap is the poetry of the streets. So I'm not sure about this whole, you know.
I mean, I just think, like, any type of song in general can be classed as poetry set to music. Because it is basically, the lyrics of a song is basically a poem set to music.
Yeah.
Raps, I don't really...
I suppose it kind of depends on what your definition of a poem is. I mean, I don't see Nicki Minaj's Starships being a poem.
Mm.
So,
but then again, I've seen poems that go on longer than short stories do.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah. I mean, some of those old saga poems, like Beowulf.
It's like where...
Beowulf, like Sigurd, the Dragon Slayer, stuff like that. They're like pages and pages of poetry. And, hell, the Iliad is a bloody saga poem. It's not a story. The Odyssey as well. I mean, people read them as if they were stories, but they're not. They're saga poems, because that was the style. You cast everything into the form of a poem.
The way she'd put that, though, she'd put rap is no poetry, not rap is not poetry. She might just mean... Rap is nowhere near as good as poetry.
I'm just on Twitter on the hashtag World Poetry Day. One from Professor Snape: roses are red, violets are blue. I thought Voldemort was ugly, but then I saw you.
Oh,
there'd be loads of them type, wouldn't there?
One from our good friend Daly, who's one of our guest presenters on BitPanel, our video game show. You got something that I adore. Boy, you were like a dinosaur. Impossible to ignore. Now let me hear you roar. Not sure what she's referring to there. Where is he? Orphan Black saying, just one, I'm a few, no family to who am I? Which is quite appropriate because it's Orphan Black. it's just kind of, yeah. Goku from Dragon Ball. Roses are red, violets are blue. Yamcha is dead. No, seriously, can someone gather the Dragon Balls?
Twitter is brilliant, isn't it? For like anything like that, it's just...
yeah.
I mean, are we not gonna basically say touch on the? Because I'm looking at the World Poetry Day and just the picture they have for it.
Yeah, I mean, this one's a good one from not Will Ferrell. Seriously, it's not Will Ferrell.
No.
It really is, but it's not. I dig, you dig, we dig, he digs, she digs. It's not a great poem, but it's very deep. So, yeah. You got some really cheesy ones as well.
Oh, God.
You get some really cheesy ones. Civilization from from the Civilization game, you know, Sid Meier's Civilization, saying, we've made Planetfall from the great mistake we learn, Kraken don't eat me. Now for one more turn. XCOM going, roses are red, violets are blue, I've killed 476 mutons, how about you?
I've got one from Henry Tudor here, the great Henry Tudor. K is for Catherine, a name I wed thrice. K is also for King. And that's me, and that's nice.
Ron Swanson has put down a great one. I like this one. Roses are red, bacon is too. Poetry is hard, bacon.
I've actually got another one from
like
Henry.
That.
I've got another one from Henry Tudor as well. He's on fire. A is for annulment, I warded myself. B is for Berlin, whose head's on my shelf.
Yes. Where are we? There are some cracking ones.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Where is it? Here. There's a good one from Amazon. There are minus and plus buttons. Let me off the bus buttons. Buttons on fizzy drinks machines. There are open the door buttons. Take me up the floor buttons. Buttons that can turn the red man green. There are round buttons, square buttons, eyes on teddy bear buttons, buttons on a gingerbread man's chest. But if you're like me, But if you're like me, then I'm sure you'll agree that chocolate buttons are the best.
That is agreed.
Chocolate buttons.
Yes, chocolate buttons. From audible.co.uk. It's a life force. It's everything. It lives in your blood. It makes your blood boil. It makes you angry. It makes you sad. It takes away from you. It gives to you. It feeds you. It energizes you. It's all of these things.
I've got quite a few here.
Yeah?
Even World Poetry Day. My one regret, the hedgehog said, is purchasing this waterbed.
Oh, I think we're heading into cheesy territory now.
Well, can I steer us into another direction?
Go on, then.
I've got a short poem about grief, sharp grief. He doesn't erase her handwriting on the kitchen whiteboard or throw anything out of the fridge. The glasses sit unfolded on the dresser.
Was that the whole poem?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
It's kind of short.
It's a short poem.
Okay.
Well, roses are red, violets are red. Everything's red. Oh my God, there's so much blood.
Where's this?
At least it's on the Huffington Post version of it.
Oh, God.
Oh, right. Yeah, you can always rely on the Huffington Post.
My idea was paracetamol. A mystery to me why sometimes you cost £1.10 but sometimes 20p.
Okay, I think we can end it on that one. I like that one. Oh, that's really good. I like that one. Sorry, it's just I don't know. Right, we are at the end of the show. We will see you all next week. I've been Rob.
I've been Owen.
And I've been Andy.
Take care, have fun. We'll see you next time for more loitering.